Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday, the 31st of July, 2021. Well, here we are, back at our usual time, the last week of the month, and following Red Saturn. In this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of good bits of national radio coming up in the next week, which, as usual, will be read by John. Then we'll have a selection of audio-described TV programmes for this week, which comes from Otley and District Talking Newspaper. Then we'll have another piece by David Arson about Tchaikovsky's opera Eugene Onegin. After that, we'll have the fourth and final piece by Hearts County Council Trading Standards Officer Darren Ward. This one is about rogue traders offering to do work on the home. And finally, we'll have this week's birthdays and events this week in past years. This week's music is called Sentimental Blues and is by Goffby. So now the news. And our readers today are Marion, Elaine, Deborah and Andy.
Hello, I am Marion and my first article is Teen Drugs Gang Behind Spate of Attacks on Rivals Found Guilty. A gang of four teenage boys who sliced off a man's nose with a machete during a spate of violent crimes against rival drug gangs in St Albans have been convicted. The young men were found guilty of conspiracy to commit robbery and GBH following a six-week trial in St Albans Crown Court. Most of the offences, which occur between December 2019 and September 2020, happened in Clarence Park, Hatfield Road and Cotlandswick in London Colney, the latter of which is where a man in his 20s had his nose sliced off with a machete on January the 13th, 2020. The offences prompted the creation of Operation Luge to target the gang who initially started with drug dealing but quickly escalated to robbing other dealers from rival gangs. Detective Sergeant Tom Evans from the local crime unit has been leading on the police response. The escalation in violence at the end of 2019 into 2020 was so dramatic that we were gravely concerned there was a real risk that someone may be killed because they were carrying weapons including machetes and swords. The offences covered in the conspiracy charge are a GBH and robbery on December the 9th, 2019 in York Road in St Albans. Robbery on December the 22nd, 2019 in Artisan Crescent in St Albans. GBH in Cotlandswick in London Colney in January the 13th, 2020. And a robbery in Sainsbury's in London Colney on September the 23rd, 2020. The following men who cannot be named for legal reasons will be sentenced at a date to be confirmed. A 19-year-old of no fixed abode, two 18-year-olds from St Albans, a 19-year-old from Welwyn Garden City. A 17-year-old from London Colney was found not guilty of conspiracy to commit GBH and no decision was reached for the count of conspiracy to commit robbery, so a retrial will be held for this matter. Detective Sergeant Evans said, "We are delighted that these teenagers were convicted today as they were dangerous not just to others, but also to themselves. They arranged drug meets in residential streets armed with machetes and swords which were witnessed by residents, including children and taxi drivers." Police teams included the local crime unit, Safer Neighbourhood team, the community safety unit and partner agencies, including St Albans City and District Council, plus the youth offending team were involved in the response. DS Evans added, "It was one of the biggest police responses to a series of incidents in St Albans. The investigation was unusual because the indictment is conspiracy to commit GBH and robbery rather than a list of charges. This was because we were unable to prove which teenager was responsible for the offences, but we knew they were all involved. The boys who were aged between 16 and 18 at the time of offending met at school in St Albans. St Albans neighbourhood inspector Andy Wiseman said, "I hope this conviction reassures the community who were unfortunate to witness violence or see weapons in the city during 2020. There is no place for violence in this district. My officers are determined to bring offenders before the courts, even with COVID-19 delays, and see them held accountable for their actions with support from youth offending teams. We wanted a long-term solution to problems to make sure every resident can enjoy our parks and improve the community's quality of life." He added, "Please always contact us if you see anyone acting suspiciously, suspect drug dealing may be taking place, or see any weapons. Rest assured, we act on every piece of information we receive."
My name is Elaine, and the first article I'm going to read you this morning is about St Albans violent crime. It's entitled, "Intervention Needed to Break the Cycle of Grooming." A family member of one of the boys convicted for a spate of violent crime says his parents begged for years for the authorities to intervene, but the pleas fell on deaf ears. She makes no excuses for the behaviour of the four guilty teenagers, but insists the cycle of grooming and forced criminality is unlikely to be broken despite their convictions, because the focus is not on finding a solution by challenging the existing culture. The woman, whose identity we are not revealing for legal reasons, is furious their head teacher did not respond to desperate pleas when the boys were being groomed and bullied in school, instead excluding them to avoid taking any responsibility. She said Hearts Police failed to respond to positive results of modern-day slavery and forced criminality from the National Referral Mechanism. The exploitation of these boys is a failure of the system. This is devastating for their families, and even though these boys are now incarcerated and have been for months, these crimes have not stopped, as the ringleaders just move on to new recruits who they entrap and put into their debt. The police then group some incidents together and are able to convict based on association, graphics and character, but not on evidence, and so it goes on. The vast amount of taxpayers' money being spent in investigations, courts and legal representation would be much better spent on intervention, support and core issues. She added, "I'm not condoning anyone's behaviour because nobody wants to live around violence, but it needs recognising where the core elements of these offences come from. Those boys didn't just wake up one morning and do these things. It's grown over time. Families that are in these situations need to be able to identify the underlying issues and early warning signs so they can step in. Hopefully, lessons will be learned from this case from all persons, including the authorities."
Hello, I'm Deborah, and my first piece is entitled "Recreational Drug Users Urged to Stop Feeding County Lines." Recreational drug users are being urged to consider how they are feeding into the county lines crimes which have become prevalent locally. Clarence Ward councillors have reacted to the conviction of four teenagers for violent crime after the spate of offences began in St Albans Clarence Park back at the start of 2020. County lines is where illegal drugs are transported from one area to another, often across police and local authority boundaries, usually by children or vulnerable people who are coerced into it by gangs. Councillor Danny Clare said, "If you're a white-collar recreational drug user sitting thinking how horrific this is, please consider whether you're feeding it. Despite the horrific level of violence here, my biggest disappointment is that more young lives have been ruined by the blight on society that is drugs, specifically through coercion and county lines. Every time this happens, we have failed as a community. The lack of accessible activities for young people and community, coupled with the financial opportunity offered to young people through drugs, are a major challenge. It takes a community to stop this. Parents, mentors, coaches, educators. And if you're concerned about your own child, reach out and get help before it's too late. Councillor Chris White added, "Local residents were understandably very anxious about this sort of violent crime in their area and will be grateful to the police for pursuing the matter so vigorously and successfully. Hopefully it will stand as a warning to anyone else who imagines that they can get away with this sort of lifestyle." County Line's drugs operations in St Albans were dealt a further blow last week, with 4 arrests in the city. Officers working alongside Operation Scorpion, a proactive campaign against organised crime in Hertfordshire, stopped a vehicle due to suspected involvement in County Line's activities. A large quantity of drugs and cash were found within the vehicle, and the 4 occupants were arrested in relation to these offences. With support from Operation Scorpion and local response teams, further searches were conducted, and a quantity of Class A drugs, related items and knives were seized. St Albans District Neighbourhood Inspector Andy Wiseman said, "St Albans, Harpenden and London Coney remain one of the safest counties to live in. However, like with any city or town, and being close to London, the County Line's operators do target young or vulnerable people living here. We are aware of County Line's, and lots of fast-time covert work is being done to find out who these people are and disrupt their activities. As part of our Prevention First focus, we work closely with our partner agencies, including schools, to educate young people about County Line's and the serious consequences of carrying knives and other weapons. In the St Albans district, we also have support from the Gangs and School team, and we work with the Operation Mantis team, a county resource specialising in targeting serious and organised crime, which works with the Eastern Regional Special Operations Unit, the National Crime Agency, and other regional and national organisations. We also work with other police forces across the country to disband groups who use violence and intimidation to deal drugs and cause misery in communities. Once we have identified a County Line's drugs line, we proactively disrupt and dismantle the supply of drugs and target those involved in exploiting vulnerable or young people. We are also working with parents and other members of the community to help protect young, vulnerable people being drawn into criminal gangs. If you suspect anyone is involved in drugs or is carrying a weapon, please get in touch with us so we can act on 999. Alternatively, you can report information online, speak to an operator in our force communications room via our online web chat, or call the non-emergency number 101.
Hello, my name's Andy, and my first item is about a nursery. The headline is, St Albans Nursery given 6 weeks' notice of shock potential closure. More than 50 families could be left without childcare provision following shock news that a nursery could be closing its doors for good in a matter of weeks. Staff at Acorns Day Nursery, which is based on the Smallford campus of Oaklands College, were told recently that the award-winning facility would possibly be shutting permanently in 6 weeks. The nursery is based in the converted manor house on the grounds and is open to private families as well as colleagues, students and employees. It achieved outstanding standard in its last Ofsted inspection and won the accolade of Best Nursery in the Hearts and School Awards 2018. A member of staff told the Hearts ad, "We have staff and over 50 families who will be affected by this, from loss of income to loss of childcare. We've worked hard and built a word-of-mouth reputation that money can't buy. I realise the past year has been tough, but it feels so unfair to all involved. Parent Will Lewis said, "The nursery is not only exceptional with a lovely family feel, but has proven a lifeline for a number of key worker parents like me and my wife over the course of this pandemic. They have bent over backwards to help my wife work extra shifts in intensive care units in London, where she was needed most. According to a 2018 report, the college has received close to £49 million in an ongoing basis for selling off land for development, yet cites the cost of building renovation as a key reason to close this vital community service down. Helping the community being a fairly laughable part of its mission statement. With 6 weeks' notice, our chances of finding a new nursery in a very crowded market are slim, potentially involving my wife or myself cutting our hours. This nursery is well attended, has a happy environment, and this shocking news six weeks' notice has come out of nowhere for parents and staff alike." Fellow parent Sarah Denby added, "The biggest problem we have faced in the time frame the college has created. They have said the consultation will conclude in September, and should they conclude that they want to go ahead with the closure, it would be immediate. This means that the very act of putting it into consultation will lead to a closure of the nursery, as parents and staff can't wait to find out the outcome if the closure would be immediate, as we can't suddenly be left without childcare and jobs. This in itself doesn't feel like a fair way to manage the process and leaves the consultation process null and void, as even if they conclude if they can remain open, they'll be left with no children or staff. The way that this has been handled and the short notice given has put parents in the position of either having to give up work or possibly having to find substandard childcare, as many nurseries in St Albans have long waiting lists, which we can't afford to join given the time frame of the closure. There also seems to be a complete overlook of the well-being of the children. They've already had to endure a lot of change and disruption to their lives over the past 2 years, and now they are facing another transition, without us even being given the option for a slow and gentle way to do this to support their well-being. As parents of the nursery, we are currently campaigning to firstly keep the nursery open, but at the very least delay the consultation or closure process to give parents more time to find suitable alternatives." Local councillor Chris Brazier added, "Oakland should have done a thorough consultation with the parents, not a sole letter of intent to close. At this time of a pandemic, parents are struggling to work, homeschooling, and get good childcare. I've contacted my fellow county councillors to seek their assistance, and I know parents have contacted Daisy Cooper MP." A spokesperson for Oakland's college said, "After much consideration, a proposal has been made to close the nursery on our St Albans campus. The proposal has been made for a number of reasons, including the extensive and costly renovation that is needed in order for the nursery to remain operational. We absolutely recognise that this is unsettling for parents and staff, and it is with deep regret that we have had to make the proposal to close. We are currently consulting with our nursery staff, and following this, a final decision will be made during the week commencing 6th of September. We are also closely working with Hertfordshire County Council to provide details of alternative provision in the area."
Oaklands College being investigated for breach of planning over nursery closure. Oaklands College has broken promises made when it sought planning approval for redevelopment by not providing a nursery on its Smallford campus, it has been claimed. In the wake of the shock announcement that the award-winning Ofsted Outstanding Acorns Day Nursery could close in a matter of weeks, damning accusations have been levelled at the college. Most prominent is the allegation that Oaklands is failing to deliver on assurances made about providing a new nursery when it sought planning permission for redevelopment, which is now being investigated by the District Council. Tracy Harvey, head of planning at St Albans District Council, said, "The proposed closure of the nursery has been reported to us as a potential breach of planning controls. We are currently investigating this." Because the existing premises at Manor House was identified as needing major work to ensure its ability to function effectively in the future, the college included proposals for a replacement nursery in Phase 2 of its master plan for redevelopment, and this received planning permission in 2017. The construction cost was estimated at £1.1 million in 2013, and the college provided evidence on appeal to the Secretary of State in 2015 as to how the scheme would be viable and delivered in manageable phases. The college said the nursery would be relocated to the site of two of the existing residential houses, which are planned to be demolished. The building is designed to be single-storey, which will enable easy access to outdoor space for all age groups in line with best early years practice. It would contain the full range of required accessible facilities for teaching, play, storage, food preparation, storage and sleeping spaces. The nursery would no longer be in the centre of the campus and so will enable the nursery to operate more effectively, drop-off and collection, whilst retaining the benefits of proximity to the college and its facilities. But this new nursery has never been materialised and Oaklands has failed to provide any alternative option, leaving parents, staff and carers with nowhere to go if Acorns closes. It is also still promoting its close links with Acorns on Facebook to attract new students to its early years and childcare course. Parent Richard Northcroft said, "Keeping Manor House was not part of the approved planning application. Retaining it has never been presented to the public as an option. Why is the college not prepared for this and planned in advance? I appreciate the college may have financial issues, but running down the clock is not an acceptable option. The economic stability argument makes little sense. The Oaklands Grange residential development north of the college will probably expand further, so more parents will require childcare nearby. It really does demonstrate a total lack of competence. There has been no transparent consultation process or forward planning since 2017. What has happened to the plans for the new nursery? And what contingency plans did Oaklands have in place to keep Acorns running if the new building could not be delivered?" The Hearts Ad has contacted Oaklands Principal Andrew Slade, Deputy Principal Harpreet Nagra, and Marketing Director David Adler for the comment. We have yet to receive a response to our inquiries.
Loan of £36 million to refinance Mortings Shopping Centre. A £36 million loan has been secured by owners Bolt BLDN to refinance the centre with UK non-bank lender Unbranded Finance in conjunction with Westbrook Partners. The loan was advanced within 6 weeks from agreement of terms and commencement of due diligence. Andrew Smith, co-founder of Unbranded Finance, said, "It was a pleasure to work with the team at Bolt BLDN on this transaction, which was completed within the timescale set by the borrower. A large amount of due diligence was undertaken within a relatively short period of time, and so all credit to the teams on both sides. The Maltings is a key retail asset, which has been extremely resilient during the pandemic and has significant potential for value added over the coming months. We are excited to have partnered with Westbrook on this transaction, a relationship we look forward to building upon." Simon Hosking, co-founder and managing director of Bolt BLDN, added, "We have been a key stakeholder in St Albans, having owned the Maltings for over 17 years. We are most committed to the long-term development of the centre, with a long-standing, forward-thinking, proactive approach to the property. The Mortings, through the retailers, office occupiers and other commercial accommodation, provides employment to many people in the area. It is the leading shopping centre in the city and continues to buck trends with a steady recovery following the pandemic, currently trading at 97% occupancy. Securing this loan will help us to implement our future-proofing strategy for the centre and enable us to enhance the asset further for the benefit of the local economy. We are extremely excited about the future of the centre and look forward to sharing our plans to improving the Mortings experience. The Mortings has recently secured a lease with Sports Direct to occupy vacant premises on the site.
Plans to build 150 homes on Greenbelt land in North St Albans approved by District Council. Developers have been given the green light to build up to 150 new homes on Greenbelt land in North St Albans, despite more than 1,500 people signing a petition against the plans. The new development on Harpenden Road will see dozens of new houses built on ex-agricultural land near to Hartwood Forest, after outline planning permission was granted at the District Council's Planning Referrals Committee on Monday night. The plans have been submitted on behalf of developers Hunston Properties and the Sewell Trust, and will see up to 150 homes built on the former farming land. Residents raise concerns about the impact so many new homes could have on traffic between St Albans and Harpenden, as well as damage to the greenbelt between the two areas. The current proposal set out plans for a total of 132 homes, including 24 two-bedroom flats, 52 three-bedroomed houses, 54 four-bedroomed houses, and 2 5-bedroomed houses. But the makeup of any development could be subject to change. The developers have committed to making 40% of the units affordable homes across a mix of the sizes. The Harpenden Road site had previously been included in SADC's draft local plan, which earmarked a number of sites to be taken off the greenbelt and to open them up for development. After the local plan was withdrawn last year, the developers argued that the significant number of homes and provision of affordable housing would constitute the very special circumstances needed to build on the greenbelt. The applicant said the benefits of their plan, including the commitment to affordable housing, new infrastructure, and being able to deliver housing more quickly than waiting until the publication of a new local plan, would comprise very special circumstances to sufficiently outweigh the identified harm in accordance with the NPPF, National Planning Policy Framework, and council officers recommended the plan was approved. However, residents have criticised the proposals and warned building work could affect the ecological corridor with Hartwood Forest and Beachbottom Dykes, as well as lead to congestion for residents. Campaign by Locals Against Sewell Housing, Clash, said any plan to implement Dutch-style sustainable transport for the site is hopelessly optimistic and entirely unrealistic, and said approval would allow the developer to wreak irreversible harm to the wildlife value of the site. Vice Chair Councillor Jeff Harrison argued that Hertfordshire County Council said they did not foresee any major traffic problems in their report, and that could make it difficult to defend at appeal if the application was rejected. Councillor Harrison added, "We've got to look at the application on its merits as it's in front of us. I've seen a number of applications for this site, and I think this is about the best one we've had all the way along. So let's move forward." Councillors voted to approve the outline plan 5-4, with one abstention. However, G. Smedley from Clash criticised the councillors' comments following the decision, Our reaction is that we find it very, very difficult to understand how, with flawed traffic data and flawed ecological data, this could be passed, quite frankly, and the Vice Chair's comments related to "we must take the HCC's documents and we can't question it" is just false. That is not part of local government procedure, not to question documents at this level. The group questioned the County Council's reports on traffic in the area and commissioned their own professional review, which was submitted to the committee, as well as their concerns about the impact on wildlife in the area. Ms. Smedley added, "It's absolutely astonishing that they haven't taken this and seen the flaws in it and allowed this to go through on Green Belt. The outline permission green lights the site for development and allows more planning work to begin on the site. Developers will need to submit more detailed plans, such as the number of dwellings and parking provision, before any building work can begin, although this will be decided by council officers rather than councillors. The outline permission is granted subject to a number of conditions, including 40% affordable housing permission, a contribution to ensure a biodiversity net gain of 10%, as well as a financial contribution towards the William Byrd Pavilion Sports Ground.
My next item has a photo with it of a platform on St Albans Station, but unfortunately there aren't any trains. Their headline is, "Train timetable for St Albans City reduced due to staff shortages." A reduced train timetable has been imposed on the Thameslink line due to staff self-isolating because of COVID. Thameslink and Southern introduced the revised timetable recently, with passengers strongly advised to check services before they travel. The Thameslink routes affected are between Sutton and St Albans City via Wimbledon and via Hackbridge, and between Gatwick Airport and Bedford. The train companies have seen a significant rise in staff needing to isolate in recent weeks, which when combined with the knock-on impact and disruption of COVID-19 over the past 17 months, means that there are fewer staff available to operate services at present. The idea is that by bringing in a reduced weekday timetable now, passengers will have more certainty about services and experience fewer short-notice cancellations, but it is still possible additional changes will need to be made on the day at weekends. Where possible, the weekday changes are focused on lines where there is overlap at stations with other train services, or there are alternative transport choices. They have also been chosen in places where new services can be created by adding station stops on alternative trains to help passengers complete their journeys. Steve White, Chief Operating Officer for Govia Thameslink Railway, said, "Regrettably, we have had to make the difficult decision to reduce some weekday services. Unfortunately, like other industries across the country, coronavirus continues to affect our operations. We have fewer colleagues available at the moment due to a significant increase recently in the number of our people affected by COVID-19. Our colleagues have continued to work tirelessly throughout the pandemic, and we're really sorry for any inconvenience caused by the latest changes. We strongly advise passengers to check before they travel, including at weekends. The reductions will be between Sutton and St Albans City via Wimbledon and via Hackbridge. One train per hour will travel via Wimbledon, and one train per hour will travel via Hackbridge to create a 2 trains per hour service in the Streatham to St Albans City section. The service group between Bedford and Gatwick Airport via Hawley, Salfords, Earlswood and Redhill will not run. Alternative trains will call at Earlswood and Salfords hourly throughout the day. This will mean a reduced service from Bedford to London, with 2 services between Bedford, London and Brighton running per hour. During the peak hours, there are extra trains that will still run during this amended timetable."
Lost Morecambe and Wise episode on TV after 50 years. A lost episode from comedy duo Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise, not seen for 50 years, was due to be screened on TV last night, Wednesday. Morecambe and Wise, the lost tapes, were set to be shown on ITV. It was first broadcast on BBC One in October 1970. Celebrity Morecambe and Wise fans taking part in the film include its narrator, Toby Jones, plus Jonathan Ross, Ben Miller and Eddie Izzard. Joining the celebrities were Eric's wife, Joan, and children, Gail and Gary. Eric Morecambe lived in Harpenden before his death in May 1984, and the Hertfordshire town's new cultural centre is named after the comedy legend. An oil painting of Eric Morecambe by artist George Anthony Rowe from 1970 also now hangs in pride of place in the new Eric Morecambe Centre. Construction company Wilmot Dixon, who have completed both the new Harpenden Leisure Centre and the Eric Morecambe Centre, arranged for the painting to be delivered to Harpenden from Dorset. Wilmot Dixon managers were happy to show it in situ to Joan Bartholomew, 94, and son Gary Morecambe on a recent visit. 2 years ago, the Hearts Advertiser reported on long-lost early 1960s photos of the Beatles appearing with Morecambe and Wise on their ATV show Two of a Kind. These pictures of Eric and Ernie with the Fab Four, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison and Ringo Starr had been uncovered in the collection of late Hearts ad photographer Tony Gregory. So how was the lost episode found? In 2020, while looking for paperwork, Eric's son Gary found an old film can in the attic. Its contents were a mystery because the label had been torn off. When the footage was checked by experts, they were amazed by what flickered into view. An episode, unseen for 50 years. The episode turns out to be the duo's first ever show made for BBC One, dating from October the 8th, 1970. It came at a crucial time in the pair's career when, after four series on BBC Two, they were about to break into the big time. The show introduced their new BBC One audience to a series of gag-packed routines. The duo's longtime collaborator, Anne Hamilton, also plays a nurse in a hospital sketch.
12 facts you might not have known about Batchwood Hall Vaccination Centre. Batchwood Hall will be closing its doors to patients on July the 31st, bringing an end to one of the most successful operations in the COVID vaccine rollout. But what do you really know about the facility and its work over the past few months? 1. It was set up by the team from St Albans Vaccination Service. 2. The unused nightclub was converted into a fully functioning vaccination centre in under a month. 3. The centre has delivered over 75,000 doses of COVID vaccine since opening in December 2020. 4. At its peak, staff at the site were able to vaccinate over 2,000 patients daily with the AstraZeneca vaccine and over 1,600 patients daily with the Pfizer vaccine. 5. A team of GPs supported by NHS staff and volunteers from practices across the city and district of St Albans and the St Albans and Harpenden GP Federation worked together to support the National COVID-19 Vaccination Programme. 6. Overall, the clinic has given 44,445 first doses and 31,820 second doses, both at the Batchwood Hall site, and also taking the vaccine out to people in care homes and other locations. 7. The team have vaccinated 43 people over the age of 100. 8. The oldest person vaccinated was 105 at time of vaccination, and 6 people aged 103 attended the vaccination centres in person. 9. Thanks to the efforts of staff and volunteers at Batchwood and other vaccination clinics, over 81% of people in West Hertfordshire, 417,000, have had their first dose of the COVID vaccine, and 65%, 320,000, have had both. 10. Staff and volunteers at the site created drive-through clinics for clinically extremely vulnerable patients, ran clinics for patients with learning disabilities, and set up outreach vaccination programmes within the traveller community, homeless shelters, women's refuges, as well as the Islamic Centre in London Colney and sporting events. 11. Care homes and patients who are housebound were amongst the earliest groups to receive their first vaccine. This included 250 residents of care homes who were vaccinated on New Year's Eve. 12. Batchwood's first clinic date was on December the 15th, 2020, and the last clinic date is currently on Thursday the 29th of July, 2021. Depending on vaccine supply, a clinic may run on Friday, July the 30th.
Fundraiser is Pumping Iron for Hedgehog Rescue. A St Albans resident will be pumping iron to raise money for a local hedgehog charity. Weightlifting novice Wendy Henrys has four hedgehogs that regularly visit her garden and decided to give something back after needing to access help from London Coney Hedgehog Rescue. A prickly pair of hogs needed treatment. One had broken its leg and the other developed a condition called lungworm after eating slugs. Wendy said, "It was recommended that I contact Esther Chant at the London Coney Hedgehog Rescue, and I was blown away by her dedication and the amount of expert care and attention she gives to the hogs at her home. She takes care of hedgehogs in every room, her garage and the garden. Esther never turns hogs away. She cares for them, treats them, and when able, returns them to the wild. Ones that cannot be released stay with her. LCHR do a brilliant job, and I want to raise awareness of the plight of hedgehogs, which have seen a huge drop in numbers, and hopefully raise donations so their valuable work will continue. Wendy is challenging herself in lifting weights to raise awareness for the charity, as she now knows how much it costs to protect the creatures. For example, to pin a broken leg costs £100. The injections for lungworm cost £30, and antibiotics between £25 to £50. She added, "Please would you lend your support to hedgehogs in two ways, by donating via my challenge and by being watchful and caring about where a hog may be hiding in the day or wandering on roads at night. Together, we can help them have a future." Esther said, "Wendy brought us a hedgehog with a broken hind leg, and our vet splinted and bandaged it to fix it. This year we've been inundated with injuries and currently have 88 hedgehogs. Wendy is amazing for doing this fundraiser, which will pay for food and veterinary treatment for future hedgehogs in need of help. Well Pet Veterinary Practice carries out all our x-rays, ultrasounds and operations. We couldn't do it without them or the kind people who donate. Hedgehogs are in severe decline and need all the help people can give. Cut a hole in your fence, allowing them access through, and ask your neighbours to do the same, and leave a shallow dish of water out. Don't feed them milk because they are lactose intolerant." And there's a picture of a hedgehog with its leg splinted and bandaged, looking like it's being extremely well cared for.
The next item is our MP Daisy Cooper's Westminster Diary. "School's out for summer, and so is Parliament, following the rise of the House last week. Like many school children, MPs didn't really get a proper end of term this year. I'm told that normally in the last few days of the summer session, Westminster is teeming with children. Lots of MPs are joined in London by their own children who want to see where mum or dad works and do a spot of family sightseeing. Not so this year, as visitors are still barred. On the final day, my Lib Dem colleague Sarah Olney, the MP for Richmond Park, WhatsApped to say she would be the very last MP to participate virtually. Closing Parliament by clicking end call was a bizarre but perhaps fitting end to the year we've had. In many ways, the long summer recess can be an inconvenience. I can't put questions to ministers and receive answers on behalf of my constituents, hold the government to account, or speak up about important causes and issues in the Commons. However, despite not being able to do any of this, parliamentary recess isn't quite the same as a summer holiday. Far from it, in fact. Most MPs use this time, or they should at least, to continue with constituency work, which can include responding to letters, visiting local businesses and organisations, and running advice surgeries for constituents. While I am looking forward to that, I also have a slight pandemic-induced sense of foreboding at the moment. I know that, like me, many others were very wary of the much-hyped Freedom Day going ahead while COVID cases were still and continue to be on the rise. So while I'd love for all of us to be playing beachside ping pong instead of getting pinged, being contacted by friends instead of by track and trace, and being social without being socially distanced, I'm all too aware that the rising cases could, as scientists keep pointing out, lead to a new vaccine-resistant variant and increased cases of long COVID. As such, do please continue to look after yourselves and each other over the summer holidays. And if there's anything you need my help with during this time or any other, please just get in touch.
And that's the end of the news. And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Yvonne Ball. Nigel Carruthers, aged 85 years. Valerie Jameson Ecope, aged 79. Joan Lomas, aged 88. And Gwen Rousel, aged 83. Now, a little more of our offering by Goffby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up this week, which, as usual, is read by John.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, July 31st. At 3:30 on Radio 4, the BBC continues its celebration of the life of the jazz trumpeter and vocalist Louis Armstrong, who died 50 years ago. In King Louis I of Britain, Byron Wallen sets out to determine just why Louis made such a connection with the people in the UK. To Radio 4 Extra at 4, a musical adaptation from 1962 of Jerome K. Jerome's comic novel Three Men in a Boat with Kenneth Horne, Leslie Phillips and Hubert Gregg. Also on Radio 4 Extra at 6, you can hear the intriguing sounding Ivan the Fool and Velisa the Wise describes the magical play about a man's determination to marry with a man-eating witch, a talking doll, a dead princess and a live skeleton, all featuring in the plot. And it's the first weekend of the BBC Proms. They continue at 7:30 on Radio 3 with music from Broadway's Golden Age, including music from South Pacific, Anything Goes, Oklahoma, Carousel, On Your Toes, My Fair Lady, and many, many more. Sunday, August 1st, Sunday worship on Radio 4 at 10 past 8 is a live service for the National Evangelical Church of Beirut, the oldest Arabic-speaking Protestant church in the Middle East, looking back at the explosion that rocked the city this time last year. At 9 a.m. Radio 4 Extra begins a second series of the adaptation of Not in Front of the Children, the 1970 comedy starring Wendy Craig. Also on Radio 4 Extra at 1, A Sting in the Tail, an adaptation of the book by conservationist Dave Coulson, founder of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. Staying with Radio 4 Extra at 20 past 2, The Past is Tessa Hadley's haunting and beautifully observed family portrait, read by Sean Thomas. There's also a drama on Radio 4 at 3 o'clock, The King Must Die, the first part of a dramatisation of Mary Renault's novel based on the myth of Theseus. The young hero sets out to solve the mystery of his birth. And lastly, at 9 o'clock on Radio 2, in the evening, Louis Armstrong Remembered by Gregory Porter. On to programmes then, which are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday this week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Same time, same radio station. Radio 4, 9:45, and repeated after midnight each day, the Book of the Week is One More Croissant for the Road, in which food writer Felicity Cloak cycles around France in search of definitive versions of classic French dishes. For sports fans, and we mentioned it last week, Radio 5 Live has live Olympic coverage throughout the day from 11 a.m. and again 7 p.m. all week. On Radio 3 at 12 noon, the composer of the week is Antonin Dvorak. Just after midday on Radio 4 and repeated at 10:45, Still Life continues Sarah Winman's story of the unlikely friendship between a British soldier and an alleged spy in wartime Tuscany. 1:45 on Radio 4, Unspeakable features Alice Musambendi, who lost her family in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, with a series looking at how to put her story into words. Radio 4, every day this week, 2:15, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the drama How to Build a Super Tower, starring Robert Glenister. Self-made tycoon Max Silver shakes up his property portfolio and is persuaded to build a new London skyscraper. Radio 4 Extra has a number of programmes this week, taking a nostalgic look at the British summer holidays. At 2 p.m. each day is British Summertime Begins, the school summer holidays from 1930 to 1980. And it's followed at 2:15 by Promenade Rock, a comedy chronicling events in Llanwicht-on-Sea during the 1950s with Nerys Hughes, still on Radio 4 Extra. Don't forget the BBC Proms is every day on Radio 3 at 7:30, back in the Royal Albert Hall, with people as well. And then at 10 o'clock, still on Radio 3, the essay Open Endings, in which writers imagine what happened next in their favourite stories, including The Lord of the Flies on Monday, Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway on Tuesday, Wind of the Willows on Wednesday, Anna Karenina on Thursday, and Jane Eyre on Friday. On to then the individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, August 2nd. On Radio 4 at 2 o'clock, The Y Factor investigates the seemingly worldwide popularity of dolls. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 continues its summer theme with Summer Over England, an evocation of summer drawn from seasonal recordings in the BBC archive from the 30s to the 1990s. 2:50, still on Radio 4 Extra, David Attenborough's life stories, this week looking at Nectar. Back to Radio 4 for the third round of Braid of Britain features contestants from Carmarthen, Letchworth, South London and Glastonbury. At 8 o'clock on Radio 4, the Radio Times choice This Union, The Ghosts, Kingdoms of England. In the first of a four-part series, Ian Hislop explores the story and legacy of the nation's four great Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, starting in East Anglia, the site of the Sutton Hoo excavation. Tuesday, August 3rd, a new political sitcom starts at 9 on Radio 4 Extra. In the morning, Party's Over follows the fortunes of Henry Tobin, Britain's shortest-serving and least popular Prime Minister. Also on Extra at 2:30, Natural Histories features the sounds of crickets. Back to Radio 4 at 4:30 in the first of a new series of Great Lives. The subject is Hans Christian Andersen. Radio 4 Extra at 6:30, Soul Music looks at the power of the Largo from Dvorak. Finally back to Radio 4 at 8 for A Bad Business. 20 years on from the collapse of the Texan energy company Enron in the wake of a massive fraud, Leslie Kerwin tries to find out if it still is easy to fleece investors of their money. Wednesday, August 4th, and for the rest of the week, cricket fans can hear coverage of the first test from Trent Bridge between England and India on Radio 4 Longwave and Radio 5 Live Sports Extra from 10:25 till 7 o'clock. Choral Evensong on Radio 3 at 3:30 comes from St Peter's Eaton Square in London. There's more sport on Radio 4 at 4pm in Sideways, when Matthew Syed tells the story of Denmark's fairy tale football win at the 1992 European Championships, seeking to uncover the secret ingredient that enabled the team to succeed against the odds. 6:30 on Radio 4 is Paul Sinner's General Knowledge. The presenter reveals facts about the history of the UK's new towns, including Stevenage, Redditch and Runcorn. And for fans of folk music, The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe, Radio 2, 9pm. Thursday, August 5th, at 9:30am on Radio 4, Metamorphosis, How Insects Transformed Our World, this week looks at blowfly detectives. Blowflies, with their ability to smell rotting meat from long distances, may be some of the most reviled insects on the planet, and they've become central to the long tradition of forensic entomology. 11am on Radio 4, Crossing Continents looks at the situation in Nigeria, where kidnappers have seized more than 1,000 students and staff from schools in raids since December. Parents face extortionate demands in exchange for the freedom of their sons and daughters, and many families are now afraid to send their children to school. 2:30 on Radio 4 Extra, Tim Marlowe looks at Vincent van Gogh's passion for sunflowers. And back on Radio 4 at 3, Open Country looks at how landscape and community inspired a sound walk in Northumberland. And staying on Radio 4 at 4:30 and repeated at 9 is BBC Inside Science with Marnie Chesterton. We round off the week, Friday, August 6th, at 10am on Radio 3, Wordsworth, Poet of the People, looks at William Wordsworth's response to the Industrial Revolution and contrasts his view with that of Adam Smith. While Wordsworth lamented the end of small farm self-sufficiency, Smith saw the potential of industrialisation. The drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 is Faded Glory, recorded on location in Rhyl and telling the story of childhood sweethearts Dave and Sue meeting again after 22 years. Their lives have taken them very different ways, while Rhyl, once a thriving seaside town, is now desperately trying to reinvent itself. The seaside theme continues on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, with Sand Between the Toes, a nostalgic feature about memories of holidays on the south coast between the wars. And why not end the week with a familiar voice of Tony Blackburn on Radio 2, 7pm, as he brings you his golden hour of pop and soul oldies. That's it for another week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Now we have a selection of audio-described TV programmes coming up in the next week. And this is read by Val from Otley and District Talking Newspaper.
Here is a selection of audio-described television programmes, which you might find interesting, for week commencing Saturday, 31st of July 2021. So, starting on Saturday, BBC One Daytime all this week is taken up by the Tokyo Olympics, which isn't audio described. But if you are really keen on this sporting event, it is also being covered on BBC Radio 5 Live. Now back to normal TV, starting at 4:45pm on ITV2. How about some animated fun with Hotel Transylvania 3, A Monster Vacation? Count Dracula and his family take a sea cruise. At 5:30pm on BBC Two, Japan with Sue Perkins, where Sue spends some time with geishas and hears from a survivor of the Hiroshima atomic bomb. Following this, still on 2, there's the feature film Pride and Prejudice, starring Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadyen. Back to ITV2 at 6:40 for Marley and Me, a comedy drama based on a true story. After John buys a puppy for his wife, their lives will never be the same again. On Channel 4 at 7 p.m, there's a rerun of Matt Baker, Our Farm in the Dales. Matt and his wife Nicola return to Matt's parents' farm to simplify its running, following his mother's accident with the livestock. This is followed at 8 p.m. by A Lake District Farm Shop. In this final episode, Master Butcher Dave uses an age-old skill to turn sheepskins into new products. On BBC One at 9:30, Casualty. Venetia and Ethan prepare for their wedding. What could possibly go wrong? There's the second part of Quiz on ITV at 9:35 p.m. The production team become suspicious of an unusual pattern of coughs from the audience. Now on to Sunday, 1st of August. And let's start at 1:55 p.m. with Death Becomes Her. Madeline wonders how her old love rival appears to be untouched by the passage of time, but finds the price of beauty is more than financial. At 6 p.m. on Sky Nature, David Attenborough's global adventure, The Rise, footage of the naturalists' journeys across the world. Moving to BBC Two, Tropic of Cancer with Simon Reeve at 7 p.m. Simon continues by travelling from the Nile to the Indian Ocean at Oman. Still on 2, but at 8, the second episode of Inside Monaco, Playground of the Rich. We look inside the Casino de Monte Carlo. Also on at 8, but on the Drama Channel, another chance to see the Christmas special from 2017 of Call the Midwife. At 9, there's a choice. On BBC One, the third part of Baptiste, Emma is very keen on finding Will. Or on ITV, Professor T, subtitled Tiger Tiger. The professor uses unconventional negotiating tactics which don't go down well with the police. Or on Channel 4, Episode 7 of The Handmaid's Tale. This time, Home. Then on Monday, 2nd of August, at 12:45 on BBC Two, and at the same time each day, Bargain Hunt, seeking antique collectibles. EastEnders is still being shown later than usual all this week at 9:05 p.m. due to the Olympic coverage, but it and all the soaps are audio described. At 7 p.m. on BBC Two, Michael Portillo continues his great Australian railway journey, tonight travelling between Canberra and Melbourne. Downton Abbey continues on ITV3 at 7 p.m, tonight showing episode 2 of series 5. This continues every night at this time. At 7:30 p.m. on BBC Four, The Wonder of Bees with Martha Kearney. Martha learns about the science, art and culture associated with the honeybee. This programme is also on at this time until Thursday. At 8 p.m. you could learn how to save a grand in 24 hours on Channel 4. This week, how to make cost-effective meals. Or on ITV, also at 8, James Martin's Islands to Highlands continues with the chef at Barry Island in South Wales. Following this on ITV at 9, Long Lost Family. Kate Brown searches for her foster brother, who was sent back into the care system after she was adopted. At 10 on ITV, Series 4 of Unforgotten. The team try to identify a headless body found on a scrap heap. This series continues every night at this time, concluding with 2 episodes on Friday. Tuesday, 3rd of August. Michael Portillo continues his Great Australian Railway Journey at 7 p.m. on BBC Two, travelling from Kuranda to Townsville. On ITV at 7:30 p.m, Wild China with Ray Mears. The adventurer travels to Tibet in search of the elusive snow leopard. At 8 on ITV, Love Your Garden with Alan Titchmarsh. He's in Birmingham creating an elegant tea garden. Or on BBC Two at 8, Secrets of the Museum. Curator Kate from the Theatre and Performance Department celebrates Alice in Wonderland. A documentary about How Healthy Is Your Gut is on Channel 4 at 8, exploring why the intestines are so important to our well-being. At 9, you can be cooking with the stars. It's French Week. Also at 9, on BBC Four, a new series, Right Around the World with Richard E. Grant. Richard travels in the footsteps of great authors. Tonight he visits Naples and the haunts of Charles Dickens and Norman Lewis. Holby City is on BBC One at 9:20. Carol is convinced to take part in Eli's stenting trial. At 10 on BBC Two is the final episode of the mockumentary Kunk on Britain. Philomena finds out about Brexit. Lastly for today, at 11:05 p.m. on Channel 4, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Dancing, a documentary about Tom Oakley, who, as well as auditioning for the dance school Rambert, tries to manage his cystic fibrosis. Now on to Wednesday, 4th of August, starting at 8, on BBC Two, Remarkable Places to Eat. Tom Kerridge goes to Edinburgh with Fred Siriex to visit kitchen and prepare venison. On ITV at 8 p.m, Craig and Bruno continue their Great British Road Trip, visiting Cheltenham and Cheddar. Also at 8, BBC Four has Earth from Space, Patterned Planet, looking at the Amazon in South America. The 2016 feature film Dad's Army is on ITV3 at 8 p.m. A reporter is sent to profile the Home Guard. Several choices at 9 p.m. On BBC One, Fake or Fortune with Fiona Bruce and Philip Mould. A small oil painting of a man in a mosque. Is it by Jean-Léon Gérôme? Or on ITV at 9, a new series, Lucan, based on John Pearson's novel, The Gamblers. Lord Lucan resorts to desperate measures to win the custody of his children. To end the day, at 11:10 on BBC Four, James May at the Edge of Space. James is trained to fly in a spy plane. Thursday, 5th of August. BBC Two is showing at 8 p.m. part 2 of Yorkshire Firefighters. Rocky firefighter Danielle is lifted on an aerial platform for the first time. On Channel 4 at 8, there's the final episode of Can I Improve My Memory? The 3 finalists must learn a foreign language in a week and then have a full conversation with Sandy Toksvig. If you would like some film action, there's GoldenEye, the James Bond film starring Pierce Brosnan, on ITV4 at 8 p.m. A Year in the Beacons continues on ITV at 8:30. The first lambs arrive on the Beacons. Then at 9, either on ITV, Undercover Big Boss. The CEO of Europe's largest caravan park operator works in disguise with his staff. Or I Am Victoria is the Radio Times pick of the day at 9 on Channel 4. Sir Anne Jones stars as Victoria, who seems to have a perfect family, job and home, but something is wrong. The Go-Between is on BBC 4 at 10. This is the 2015 dramatisation of L.P. Hartley's novel about lost innocence at the turn of the 20th century. Finally, to Friday, 6th of August. At 6:55pm on More4, Escape to the Chateau, DIY. A big wedding is at risk. Channel 4 has a new series, Epic Wales, Valleys, Mountains and Coasts, at 8pm. This episode focuses on individuals like cattle farmer Rodri Jones and fisherman Mark Gainfoot. There's Father Brown on the Drama Channel at 8. This episode is The Brewer's Daughter. Or there's Doc Martin on ITV3. At 8pm, Faith, and at 9, From the Mouths of Babies. At 8:30pm on ITV, Endeavour investigates the disappearance of a teacher from a secretive school in Icarus. BBC One has King Gary at 9:30pm. Gary is convinced Teddy is a golfing prodigy and enters him in a golf tournament, only to find the date clashes with the school spelling bee. To end the day, there's another Die Hard film, A Good Day to Die Hard, on ITV at 11:10pm. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
And now we have David Ireson talking about opera, and especially Tchaikovsky's work, Eugene Onegin.
Hello, David Ireson with you again. Having had glimpses of coronation music, keyboards, bassoons, and composers from Robert Fairfax to Percy Grainger, Gilbert and Sullivan, Glenn Miller and Dave Brubeck, I thought we might move into pastures new and investigate the world of opera, where players and singers come together to tell stories. I've chosen Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, as I love the music and really enjoyed conducting it. You might recognise the waltz from Act 2. I've conducted for St Albans Chamber Opera since its foundation over 30 years ago and had the fantastic opportunity of working on operas by Monteverdi to Mozart and Verdi to Britten. Opera is about emotions and relationships, in the case of Eugene Onegin, failed ones, and so composers can use both the orchestra and the singers to express the feelings of the characters in the stories. Conducting opera is scary and exciting and immensely satisfying when it is going well, though fraught with potential dangers. I imagine it's rather like tightrope walking and works best when you are calm and in control. Easier said than done. The conductor must try to help the singers and players give their best performances, pace the drama, and try and make sure that the audience can hear the words of what is being sung and follow what is happening. It's a collaborative process too. Lots of people with many different talents are all engaged in telling the story, be they singers, players, set builders, costumiers, makeup artists, choreographers, or the stage director. It's fraught with danger because it's a minefield of opportunities for things to go wrong, on stage or in the pit. On stage, doors won't open or close, props are in the wrong place, cues are missed, the lighting fails, or the list is horrifyingly long and completely unpredictable. Music is well suited to portraying emotion, often love, but also anger and jealousy, loneliness, sadness, and joy too. And this makes opera, with the dramatic stories and situations with which it presents us, the ideal vehicle for composers to give full range to their expressive gifts. Let me try and illustrate some of these things with Tchaikovsky's wonderful music. He wrote the opera Eugene Onegin when he was in his late 30s, after a disastrous marriage. His life was punctuated by personal crises. He never really recovered from the separation from his mother when he was sent away to boarding school to train as a civil servant. His mother died when he was still at school, and he also lost his great friend and colleague Nikolai Rubinstein. His relationship with his patron, the wealthy widow Nazdek von Meck, lasted for 13 years on the basis that they never met each other and ended badly, and he died of cholera at the age of 53. Despite this apparently sad life, his music is often joyous and life-affirming, the ballet music in particular. Just think of Sleeping Beauty, Swan Lake, and Nutcracker. The opera Eugene Onegin is based on Pushkin's novel in verse and opens with an introduction, not an overture, which sets the mood. We are in a country estate with a mother and her two daughters, Olga and Tatiana, and their nurse. The peasants are coming in from the fields, having successfully completed the harvest, and dance and sing a folk song. The recordings are in Russian, so don't worry too much about the words. Lenski, a poet, arrives with his friend Onegin and sings a duet with the elder sister Olga, with whom he is in love. Onegin takes notice of Tatiana and wonders why Lenski has gone for Olga, although Olga appears the more jolly of the two and thinks her sister is a bit of a romantic. This proves to be true when Tatiana falls for Onegin and writes him a passionate letter. This is one of those moments where Tchaikovsky paints a picture of the young, impetuous and impressionable girl. It's not a relationship, but a moment where we learn about the feelings of Tatiana, the famous letter scene. The translation of what she sings is, "To write is foolishness, I know it. But as I love him, I must show it, and though I suffer evermore, the highest joy may lie in store. Desire has poisoned me with longing. All day long, I only think of him." By way of a contrast, we then hear a chorus of girls singing happily. And this is then followed by the scene where Onegin comes to see Tatiana and is rather cold and dismissive towards her. He does finish his aria by singing, "I'll always love you as a brother, or yet maybe more dearly still. I promise you, I beg you not to feel rejected. Your confidence will be respected. But try to practice self-control, for some men, unlike me, abuse such youthful innocence as yours." So the act finishes with Onegin painted as someone who takes himself rather seriously and considers himself somewhat superior. Act 2 begins with a ball at which the guests are enjoying themselves and includes the waltz we heard at the start. Onegin, however, says he's bored with these bourgeois people and will amuse himself by flirting with Olga with the express intention of making Lenski jealous. This is all too successful, and Lenski challenges Onegin to a duel. Lenski sings an aria saying how far away seemed the happy days when he was young. Onegin having finally turned up, the duel takes place and Onegin shoots Lenski. And the act ends with Onegin, his head in his hands, appalled at what he has done. Act 3 begins some years later at a social function in St. Petersburg, at which Onegin is again complaining about how bored he is with travelling and socialising and how he still feels anguish at the death of his only friend. At this point, there is a grand entrance of the Princess Gramina, a young and beautiful woman who has married Prince Grema, a retired general, and Onegin recognises her as Tatiana. Prince Grema now sings a wonderful aria explaining how lucky and blessed he feels by marriage to Tatiana. He realises how empty life was before his marriage and how the gift of love should be treasured. Tchaikovsky's writing lets us feel Grimmel's thankfulness. Here is the aria. After this, Grandma introduces his wife to Onegin, and they admit that they have met before, a long time ago in the country. Grandma retires, and Onegin says, "Is this the same Tatiana, the timid country girl whose touching innocence and love I so heartlessly rejected?" He realises that he does love her, and determines to win her back. She accuses him of only wanting her because she's now rich, and he bitterly regrets how he treated her before. She eventually admits that she still loves him, but now married will remain faithful to her vows and so rejects him. The opera ends with Onegin realising how desperate is his situation, failing to win the one who was so passionately in love with him all those years before, when he was so indifferent and coldly superior. Disgraced and shamed, now only death remains. Tchaikovsky's music helps us feel all the raw emotions of the story, the passionate love of the young girl, the anger and jealousy which leads to the duel, and the remorse of Onegin for the death of his friend, and finally the realisation that he has missed his only chance of happiness with someone who has proved herself to be faithful to her husband. In the Abbey Theatre, where St. Albans Chamber Opera puts on its productions, there is no orchestral pit, and so we use a reduced orchestration with a band of around a dozen players. One of the advantages of this is that the whole grand opera thing is scaled down, and we can feel more intimately the emotions of the participants. It's a sort of close-up of the drama. Our operas are always performed in English, too, as I think it's essential that the audience can understand what is going on and can get involved in the story. If you've never tried opera, thinking that it is a bit highbrow or not for you, I would encourage you to give it a try and listen to some of the great music in which composers have used all the musical forces at their disposal to involve us, the audience, in the ups and downs and emotions of life. I hope you've enjoyed this brief glimpse into the world of opera. Thanks for listening. Here to finish with are the final moments of the opera, when Tatiana pleads with Onegin to leave her alone, and she goes, leaving Onegin to bitterly regret his past.
We now have the last of four pieces by Darren Ward from Hearts County Council's Trading Standards Office. And this one is about scams perpetrated by rogue traders on work on unsuspecting people's homes.
As we're all spending a lot more time at home during the pandemic, we've also been doing a lot more home improvements. But unfortunately, rogue traders have been taking advantage of that. it's also been an ideal time for cold callers to catch consumers at home, offering to do all types of work. We at Trading Standards have noted an increase in rogue trader activity, particularly around roofing work. However, the advice I'm about to give applies to any work you may have done in or around your home and garden. Now, rogue traders will try to put you under pressure to agree to work by exaggerating the amount of work required or even invent the need for work to be done at all. They will then charge much more than the normal for the work, which is likely to not be of a particularly high standard and may need to be done again. We've had complaints of traders knocking on people's doors offering to do work as they are in the area or working down the road on a neighbour's house, when that's just not the case. Often they'll tell you that they've spotted a slipped roof tile or some damaged guttering on your house, which they can fix immediately there and then, and it won't cost much. Now, this is where the fraud starts. These small jobs often escalate into something you weren't expecting, and you're put on the spot to agree to bigger works that you didn't originally think you needed doing. Where a small job turns into a much bigger one, we call this bouncing the job. Trading Standards has seen an increase in these complaints in this type of upselling, including these two recent examples. In the first case, the work was originally stated to be a small job, just a replacement of a few tiles. Once up on the roof, the trader said the owner needed a whole new roof for reasons of health and safety and quoted a top price of £40,000. A quote of £26,000 was agreed to and work commenced, but things didn't go right and the owner then contacted us at Trading Standards. We provided legal and practical advice, negotiated a reduction in price and provided support whilst the work continued. In the other case, the cold call was by a trader offering to carry out a small job for £60 to remove a blocked air brick at ground level. He returned the next day to start work and said the problem was far worse than he first thought, and now he needed £2,000 to renew the damp-proof course. He also then said scaffolding was needed, as apparently the roof battens were rotten and this was causing damp problems. He'd have to replace the whole roof for £20,000. At that point, the resident got suspicious and asked us at Trading Standards for help. Again, in this case, we supported the homeowner, advising her not to pay, and we informed the trader he was not to return. A professional surveyor who later looked said the extra work was completely unnecessary. There was no need for damp proofing or roof repairs. In both these cases, homeowners were put on the spot to agree to large works they didn't originally think needed doing. Never feel pressurised into agreeing to additional work there and then. Give yourself time to think and obtain comparison quotes. Confirm if the work is actually required. Once you know it is, get a couple of quotes to ensure the traders are charging the same kind of price for those works and then decide. If you find a good trader to carry out works, it's more likely the job will go well and that you'll be charged a reasonable price. Trading Standards, however, has noticed these complaints rising as a result of consumers trying to do the right thing, not dealing with cold callers, and instead going online to good trader sites to find someone to carry out works. Do beware, there are a great many of these sites out there, and they don't all carry out the same level of checks, meaning that rogues can get onto the sites and appear to be vetted. Online reviews may also not quite tell the whole story. Take extra care to double-check the scheme you want to use, where there is one, and use your local Trading Standards approved trader scheme. Now, our advice is always use a trustworthy and competent trade person. Try to obtain 3 quotes for the work required. Try to use personal recommendations. Use traders that have actually been used by your friends or family. If you need to use a trusted trader site, ensure that they carry out comprehensive checks. Contact your local Trading Standards service on the Citizen Advice Line, which is 0808 223 1133, and ask them if they've got a trusted trader scheme. Do not respond to cold callers or let them convince you that a job is urgent. Remember, if at any point you feel you're being pressured or the trader won't leave, then call the police on 999. We urge anyone who is wanting advice on doorstep trading and wishes to report an incident to contact the aforementioned Citizens Advice Consumer Service on the number I've spoken about. I'll give that to you again. It's 0808 223 1133. Remember, they give free, independent and impartial advice on all consumer issues and give us at Trading Standards vital intelligence to assist them in tackling these rogues. One last piece of advice regarding anyone that calls when you're not expecting them. If you're not sure, don't open the door. Thank you for listening.
Now we have our piece of music, Sentimental Blues by Gothby, in its entirety. And now here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 1st of August 1936, French fashion designer Yves Saint Laurent was born in Oran, Algeria, to French parents. He founded his fashion label in 1961 and is regarded as being amongst the foremost fashion designers of the 20th century. He's also noted for popularising women's trousers for all occasions. On the 2nd of August 1932, Peter O'Toole was born in Leeds. The British stage and film actor starred in Lawrence of Arabia and won a Golden Globe for his performance in Goodbye, Mr. Chips. He holds the rather sad record for having the most nominations for the Oscar for Best Actor, 8, but never actually winning. On the 3rd of August 1938, Terry Wogan was born in Limerick, Ireland. Between 1993 and 2009, he hosted his BBC Radio 2 weekly breakfast programme, Wake Up to Wogan. He was also the voice of BBC's coverage of the Eurovision Song Contest from 1980 until 2008, when he became disillusioned by the factional voting of many countries. On the 4th of August 1901, Louis Armstrong, nicknamed Satchmo, or Satchel Mouth, was born in New Orleans. And he did call himself Lewis and not Louis. The American trumpeter and vocalist is one of the most influential figures in jazz. Some of his most popular hits were What a Wonderful World, Hello Dolly, Ain't Misbehaving, and Blueberry Hill. On the 5th of August 1930, Neil Armstrong, the American astronaut, was born in the wonderfully named town of Wapakoneta in the state of Ohio, USA. He had been a US Navy pilot, but was a civilian when he became an astronaut. He went into space on two occasions, first as one of the crew of Gemini 8, before being selected as the commander of Apollo 11. Thus, he became the first person to walk on the moon. On the 6th of August 1972, Jerry Halliwell, the singer and former Spice Girl, was born in Watford. She rose to prominence in the 1990s as Ginger Spice with the Spice Girls, and with over 90 million records sold worldwide, they became the biggest-selling female group of all time. On the 7th of August 1876, Margaretha Zeller, the Dutch exotic dancer, better known by her stage name Marta Hari, was born in Leeuwarden in the Netherlands. Having spent some time in the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, she took her stage name from the Malay word for the sun. During the First World War, she was accused of being a spy for both sides of the conflict, though much of the evidence against her was falsified. She was executed by a French firing squad in 1917. And finally, some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 1st of August 1980, Vigdis Finnbogadottir was elected President of Iceland. This is significant because in doing so, she became the world's first democratically elected female head of state. On the 2nd of August 1870, the Tower Subway in London was opened. This was a tunnel under the Thames, which held a narrow-gauge railway. Passengers were conveyed on cable-hauled wooden carriages. However, this was uneconomic, and the company was bankrupt within 4 months. The tunnel was converted to pedestrian use, and 1 million people a year crossed under the river, paying a toll of a halfpenny. The opening of the toll-free Tower Bridge nearby in 1894 caused a drop in income, and the tunnel closed in 1898. It still exists today, but is used only for water mains and electric cables. On the 3rd of August 1936, Jesse Owens won the gold medal in the 100-metre sprint at the Olympic Games in Berlin. He was the most successful athlete at those games, having won 3 more gold medals for the long jump, the 200-metre sprint, and the 4x100 relay. When he returned to the USA, there was a reception in his honour at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. However, as a black man, he was not allowed to enter through the front door. He had to go round the back and travel up in a service lift. On the 4th of August 1914, in response to the German invasion of Belgium, the United Kingdom declared war on Germany. Germany's plan was to defeat France in 6 weeks and then concentrate its forces on attacking the Russian Empire. However, their advance was halted at the Battle of the Marne, and by the end of 1914 it had become a war of attrition using trench warfare, with the consequent huge loss of life. On the 5th of August 1962, Marilyn Monroe was found dead in her apartment in Los Angeles. She had died late the previous evening of an overdose of barbiturates. In the previous few years, she had been suffering from mental health issues and substance abuse, and had been sacked from her last film because of her unreliability. A sad end for a talented and beautiful actress. On the 6th of August 1945, a Boeing B-29 of the United States Army Air Forces dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima in southern Japan. This one bomb killed more than 70,000 people instantly, and many tens of thousands more died later from burns and radiation poisoning. 3 days later, a second atomic bomb was dropped on the city of Nagasaki, with similar effects. On the 7th of August 1947, the Norwegian scientist Thor Heyerdahl's balsa wood raft Kon-Tiki ran aground in the Tuamotu Islands of the Pacific Ocean after a 101-day, 4,300-mile journey from Lima in Peru. It was an attempt to prove that the inhabitants of the Easter Island could have come from South America. This theory was controversial even at the time, and is now overwhelmingly rejected by modern scientists. Still, it doesn't take anything away from Heyerdahl's achievement of the voyage. Kon-Tiki itself is now housed in its own museum in Oslo, along with Ra II, the reed boat in which he sailed from West Africa to Barbados in 1970. And so we come to the end of this programme. Many thanks to Marion, Elaine, Deborah, and Andy, our readers today. To John, who read the radio highlights. To Mark, who makes all the copies of the programme. And to Michelle, who ensures you get yours. So that's all from News Extra for July 2021. And with that, I'll say goodbye.